You're listening to the Heart of Giving podcast with Art Taylor, powered by bbbgive.org. Here, we explore the motivations that form the basis of giving and service. We inspire generosity and celebrate the transformative effects that giving and service have on the human spirit and on community. The conversations featured on the podcast also uncover giving strategies that educate and provide tools to help listeners make impactful gifts of both their time and money. We hope you enjoy this episode.
Welcome to the Heart of Giving podcast, powered by bbbgive.org. Give.org is the nation's standards-based charity evaluator and your one-stop source for information on giving and reports on the most asked about charities. I'm Art Taylor, your host. Well, as we come to the end of our first season with the Heart of Giving podcast, we thought we would do a retrospective of some of our guests and episodes on the question of what drove them to a career of service and giving and what types of causes in some cases they support. I hope you'll enjoy this walk down memory lane. Sam Cobbs, the CEO of Tipping Point Community, talks about his father and the influence he had on his life and his career. For you, growing up in Mississippi, I believe you stated in a piece that I read recently that you learned a lot from your father, who was giving a lot back to the community.
Yeah, so definitely. And thanks again, Art. My understanding how important it was to give back to the community really did come from my father and my family. And so to give a little bit of context, I was born and raised in the Mississippi Delta. And I like to say that Mississippi is considered as the poor state, and the Delta is the poorest part of Mississippi. And so that is where I was born and raised. And my father had the luck and the opportunity to be a high school football star, and therefore he was able to go to college. But he was one of the first African-American businessmen in our little small town of Indianola, Mississippi. And I saw the way that he gave back. And I often say that the first reentry program that I ever saw was my father ran it. And it wasn't that he was intending to do reentry. It was just that the people that he hired, he was a roofer. And the people that he hired usually had been in jail or in prison and were coming back to their community. I also saw him as the first Parks and Rec director that I ever saw. And mainly because he had the only ladder that was tall enough to change the nets on the basketball hoop on what we call the black side of town. And so we had a black side of town and a white side of town where I grew up, with a railroad track that ran down the middle. And then finally, he was also ran the first mentor or big brother, big sister program, because he was also the Boy Scout troop leader. And I asked him one day, I said, "Dad, why every time we go somewhere, we have people with us, we have other boys with us?" And what he told me was like, they are not in the same situation that you're in, where they have someone who is taking interest in what it is that they're doing. And so I am going to be that person. And so he was really proud, and he always called them his boys, and his boys always looked at that time with fondness. And so now they are doctors and lawyers and the head of the physics department at Howard University. And all of them came from his Boy Scout troop. And so I saw the way that he gave back to his community. And that was something that I didn't know it at the time, Art, but was being instilled in me, in this whole feeling that whom much is given, you have the responsibility to also give much to others. And so that's where the idea of giving back to community came from for me.
Angela Kim, a former student of mine, now an executive in a school, talks about how education equity was so important to her growing up and why she's contributing in her own way to that today. How does a person go from a lucrative career in corporate America to getting a master's degree in nonprofit management and restarting her career in a charter school?
So to answer your question, I think it might be a bit of a longer story, but I think it has a lot to do with my upbringing and sort of my early childhood of why I ultimately made this switch in my career. So in my childhood, we grew up in Baltimore County in Maryland. My family came here as immigrants. I came here to the U.S. when I was 3. My parents obviously came here in search of the American dream. We were not well off, and we were surrounded by a huge community of other Korean American immigrants in the Baltimore area that all really supported one another to obviously, you know, achieve that American dream. And our upbringing, my sister and I, our upbringing was really shaped a lot by the mentality and culture that surrounds our family being Korean American, which is that largely our education is priority number one, and your success is really defined by making sure you are financially independent and wealthy and having a job that makes you, your family, and your parents proud. So that was my really main driver for a really, really long time. And that was really ingrained in how I thought about my future and what that should look like. So we eventually started living in a more middle-class suburban neighborhoods. You know, my parents were doing much better and they really were able to achieve that American dream for my family. And my sister and I really grew up in a wonderful neighborhood and an environment and everything. And the way that my parents were able to do that were because they didn't have great English speaking skills and they didn't have, you know, high school, college degrees, they owned a variety of different kinds of businesses in inner Baltimore County or inner Baltimore City, I'm sorry. And so my sister and I, on the weekends, we spent a lot of time down in the inner city parts of Baltimore. And we spent decades there on the weekends helping my parents out. And so my sister and I would be ringing up the cash register. We'd print lottery tickets. We would grab stuff. We would stock the shelves. And over those decades, I really saw the stark contrast between how my family and how these families in Baltimore really grew up and how completely different our lives were. And I didn't really understand what that meant when I was a kid, but as I grew older, I started to really realize the impact of what that meant for these families and the kids that were living in this area compared to what my future looked like and how I envisioned my future. And so I started realizing that the impact of their environment, their upbringing, the health and nutrition that was made available to them, it was definitely in areas where they were food deserts. So I don't think they had the same accessibility to healthy and nutritious foods that we had. Their education opportunities were quite different. And just the crime and violence and drugs that were much more prevalent in inner city Baltimore compared to where I grew up, all of these things combined really meant that their future and their challenges that they would face to reach their future goals were completely different for them than compared for me. So as I really grew older, that really became such a huge differentiator for me. And that's when I really, really understood the harsh realities of what privilege and opportunities are so vastly different and how it's really unfair that I was aspiring to go to college. I was thinking about majors. I'm thinking about careers. I was thinking about what kind of businesswoman I would like to be. And I was thinking at the time that that's probably not the same for these kids and or might look very different. And I don't pretend to understand all of their lives, obviously, but just from what I could see, that was made very, very apparent to me. So at that time, I really, you know, as a high schooler, I really wanted to commit myself to serving later in life. When I grew up, I was more able to give back, however that would look, you know, whether it was financially or serving or whatever. I really wanted to give back to the communities that didn't have the same opportunity and shot that I did. So jumping ahead a bit, I went to college at UMCP at University of Maryland College Park, and I majored in communications and public relations. And I had this one internship with the Boys and Girls Clubs of Greater Washington, which was a headquarters in the DC metro area. And I loved that mission. It was working with kids, a lot of them in lower income areas, which I really connected to because that's what I saw when I spent a lot of time in Baltimore. And I found that it really fed my soul. And I loved my time there. I just enjoyed everything about it. And when I left that internship, I really vowed to come back there someday in the future when I was much more stable and I had a career going and I was more in better capacity to give back. So years later, I finished college. I was in my career path. I was in my 20s. I was doing great. And I was working for various tech companies. I was making money, you know, successful as I had defined it. I was building my career. So I felt I was in a good place now to start giving back. And so I started volunteering. I started working with animal organizations, community organizations. And then I even went back to Boys and Girls Clubs now as a volunteer with more experience, with more capacity to give, whether financially or with my time. So I started off working on events there. I started volunteering for a lot of different things in a lot of different capacities. And I absolutely loved it. And this is all the work that I did in my spare time. I also started something called the Next Generation Committee, which was a junior board. And I saw that there was a need for folks like myself at the time that were young professionals. And we really wanted to give back and do more. And so I had that group going for several years. And then I also became a board member for a number of years. At the same time during this period of my life, I really started realizing I was not enjoying my day job, which I was working for very wonderful technology companies. And I just was not fulfilled anymore. I was going to work and it was just becoming a chore. And it was just not motivating me the same that it used to. And I felt a huge pull and I gravitated so much more to my volunteer work at the time. My volunteer work at the time working with Boys and Girls Clubs, I thought about, I was excited about it. I could see the impact that I was making immediately and then long term. I could see the change that I was making. I really had purpose and mission with my volunteer work. So for years, I actually struggled with this decision whether I should stay with my career path or to switch over to the nonprofit world. It was a major switch in my head that I needed to make for myself, that I can move away from, you know, success being only defined by financial success and that there's much more to life than just that. And I really didn't want to have any regrets. So after a long time and talking to a lot of people, I finally made the switch. I made that jump. I decided to get my master's at Columbia University with a nonprofit management program. And I finally had that purpose and mission to why I was doing this. And I don't think I ever had that before. So I'm really glad that I waited to get my master's degree because I went into it soaking up everything. And I just had that burning desire and intention with attending the program. And I just absolutely loved everything about it. And the reason why I did it was because I obviously wanted to be successful and not go into the industry with having assumptions and stereotypes. And I needed to get rid of that quickly. And I really obviously wanted to learn from industry experts like yourself, Art, and then other veterans in the field, and then also really meet my peers and colleagues that I would be leaning on in the future. And I have absolutely no regrets about that.
Judy Belk, the CEO of the California Wellness Foundation, who grew up in the segregated South, talks about how philanthropy played a role in her becoming the woman and professional she is today, and why it's so important to give back.
So one of the first questions I like to ask my guests is how they got started in this life of service. For you, it must have been something that triggered this interest in you from your days as a young girl here in Alexandria. Tell me about that. Tell our guests a little bit about the young Judy Belk.
Oh, the young Judy Belk. My life really started, I always say, about 10 miles from the White House. I grew up at a time in this country where, again, not dissimilar to what's happening now, that this country was tackling race. So I grew up in Alexandria, Virginia, born in a segregated hospital in Alexandria, Virginia, before it was a tourist destination. And my life in terms of what I had access to, what I didn't have access to, was determined a lot by the color of my skin. I lived for, you know, the first 10 years of my life in a small, supportive African-American neighborhood in Alexandria, but without access to water or indoor plumbing. It's pretty unbelievable when you think, because I'm old, but I'm not that old. I would say that the first significant impact on me that's reference to my journey is getting access to public education. When I started school, the Brown decision was the law of the land, but the state of Virginia always was a tough nut to crack on institutional racism, just fought it. And the city of Alexandria, that's part of their history. And so my mother, very courageous, at the age of 25, joined a group of other African American parents, raising their hands, saying that they would be test case for the Brown decision. And this is where philanthropy came in. Of course, the NAACP, the Legal Defense Fund, they were just amazing African-American attorneys. But the case was funded by the Jewish philanthropic community in Alexandria. They made it happen. As a result of that, we won the case. I had access to school because when I started out, I was going to a separate but very unequal school. That decision really changed my life. But it would take another 10 years before the city would really integrate its schools. And in fact, it was so significant that Hollywood made a movie about it. Remember the Titans,
right?
Denzel Washington. That was about T.C. Williams, the school that I was in. So that was one. I guess the other one, which is also a really important lesson for me about the impact of philanthropy. A generous philanthropist in Alexandria decided that every child should have access to the arts. And so she provided funding to a community-based organization that I was a part of to provide us the opportunity to go over to the National Theater to see professional arts. And so I remember seeing the opera Carmen for the first time. It was the first time I saw a live professional arts production. I was mesmerized. And as a result of that, I have been a lover of the arts ever since. That philanthropist, I wish I knew who she was so I could, you know, reach out to her family to thank her for giving me that opportunity. And then the final game changer for me was I was really interested in the arts and communication, and my drama teacher encouraged me to apply to some strange sounding school called Northwestern. And I almost didn't apply because I thought it was in Seattle. It's really outside of Chicago. I applied. I got in. I was the first, my parents did not go to college, and the idea that they were going to let me go to some strange school they had never heard of, that was a big discussion in my family. But when they saw the financial package, the letter, which had a big zero by parental contribution, my father said, okay, yeah, I guess you can go. And this was, at least in my life, I didn't have the opportunity to visit colleges beforehand. So my parents drove me to Northwestern, dropped me off. And that too changed my life because a group of philanthropists, donors to Northwestern really felt that it was important to provide philanthropic support to someone like me. So lots of stories of where philanthropy, giving has really made a huge, huge impact. And for all of those experiences, I certainly had no idea that there was even a job or an opportunity to make a living in philanthropy. But what I did get from that experience was a belief that collective action, courage by my mother, support and resources can make a difference in terms of social justice, and generosity and giving and service can make an impact in the lives of so many. It certainly made an impact in the life of a young Black girl growing up in a segregated Alexandria.
That's amazing. Bill Novelli, a successful entrepreneur who lacked meaning in his life, decided to make a change and work in the nonprofit sector and provide service to organizations throughout his career. Bill, let me start the interview off by just getting a little bit about Bill, the young boy growing up as you did, and how did that sort of transition you into your career?
Well, Art, I was a very lucky kid, I think. I grew up in a blue-collar town near Pittsburgh, a wonderful family, and we had what I called immigrant values. So my parents weren't immigrants, but my grandparents were, and they lived not far from us. And those immigrant values that I think of are, I think, the same kinds of values that we want to impart to our kids and our grandkids today. A real love of country, an appetite for hard work, a reverence for education, all the things that you and I and our society should stand for.
Well, that's so true. And it's made this country the power that it is, those values that you just expressed. Bill, when I think about impact, I can't help but think about the work that you've done. And we're going to get into that as we talk through this interview. But you've headed some of the most, I would say, successful organizations and campaigns that we've seen in the country. I'm sure a lot of our guests would also want to know how it was that you transitioned from a life of business to one of social impact. Talk to us a bit about what it was that drove you to leave a public relations firm that you helped found to creating actually an organization for good and doing all of the great work that you've done that we're going to talk about.
Well, I can tell you, Art, it was not a straight line. It took me a while to figure it out. So as you say, I started in business. I was a marketing manager at Unilever, and I was doing well. And then I went to a hot New York ad agency on Madison Avenue. And these were back in the days when Madison Avenue was hot, you know, the Mad Men era. And I was doing well there also. But I had a problem. And my problem was I couldn't find any what I was thinking of as social relevance in my work. Mm. I was marketing kids' cereals, cat food, dog food, hair groom, no heavy lifting. I had a young family, but it just wasn't doing it for me. And then one of the stories I like to tell is I came back from a client meeting, and I had been working with the client on a new kids' cereal and a new dog food. And this young copywriter came into my office and he said, hey, we're doing some concept statements for that new kid cereal. Do you have any samples? And Art, I reached into my briefcase and I took out the dog food. And I threw it across the room. I said, yeah, here. And he caught it and he said, yeah, yeah, we can sell that. And I said to myself, it's time, bro. It's time to change.
We can sell that.
We can sell that. And I don't mean to denigrate business and industry. I've spent half my life in the private sector. But from there, I found my way. I went to the Peace Corps. I didn't go to Mozambique or Colombia. I helped them market the Peace Corps from Washington, D.C.
Mm.
And Art, these were the days when these host countries, they loved the Peace Corps just as they do today. But they wanted more volunteers with agricultural experience, more nurses, more MBAs, older volunteers, and especially they wanted people who looked like them. So my job was to try to reposition the Peace Corps to attract those kinds of volunteers.
Joan Fallon discovered early in her life the importance of businesses also working for society. And that's why she started a company focused on finding treatments for those with autism. Your life has touched philanthropy in a wide variety of ways. Everything from how you do your business to how you volunteer your time. Was this something that you planned, or is it more, I guess, serendipity, or just how circumstances came about?
Thank you. That's a great question, Art. You know, I think that since I was a young child, I had three loves. They were medicine, children, and baseball, or actually anything with a ball. And my favorite gift of all time was I was 10 years old and my cousin was in medical school and he brought me a real stethoscope. And it was a treasure, you know, that I've had my whole life because I just always had those loves. And as my life, you know, was a journey, as all of our lives are, I was able to intertwine all of those things together in a way I could never have dreamt about either as a child or even as a young adult. I was always an athlete. You know, if I was born at a different time, I probably would have been a professional athlete, but I have been able to be a part of sports, professional sports, on the philanthropic side, as advisors like for the ADA, for the new Yankee Stadium in 2009. And I've been very blessed that I've been able to put those things all together, including in my main work today, which is in my biotech company, which is working in autism. And we do a lot of philanthropic work around autism, as well as a lot of other issues such as education. Like you mentioned, the Dream School, a charter school in New York that was founded around baseball. It was founded by a group of individuals who fixed a sandlot to allow children to play baseball in East Harlem. And it grew and grew and grew. And now, you know, Major League Baseball, the Yankees, the Mets are all represented on the board and a part of the organization. And it serves a tremendous need in East Harlem between the schools, the elementary, middle, and high schools, as well as the sports teams that they sponsor.
Ashley Axios grew up with an eye for art, and she understood as she grew the impact that art could have on social change. So Ashley, let me get into your background and history a little bit to try to flesh out how you arrived to this place now where you see design as such a powerful tool for shifting society in a positive direction. Were you someone growing up who had this sense that I need to engage in something artistic or something design oriented? What led you to a career in this field?
It's a great question. For me, I was exposed early on to difficult circumstances, to poverty and to homelessness. And so that's, I think, one side of what led me into design and design for social change was just seeing the need and the reality in a very kind of poignant, sticky way. And the other side of it was certainly being a creative kid and liking to make things and to find solutions that were more visual or tactile compared to maybe some other peers. So together, and it took me quite a long time to to really find the flow and figure out what fields combine these things, but they really work incredibly well together in design for social change and looking at the reality of a situation as it is today, a big situation like homelessness in a city or something smaller like an interface, and imagining a better future in reality and kind of using the skills that I've acquired over time to put those together into really proposing solutions to those problems and painting a path that helps people get from that point A to point B. But early on, it was all about, I think, creative thinking and making and allowing myself also. I think most creatives spend so much time in their youth just observing the world around them and kind of taking it all in. So, you know, whether it was the hard stuff, like being exposed, like I said, to homelessness or poverty, or just some of the more beautiful things, a real skill that I built up early on is just being able to really see what was happening around me and being still and just taking in the reality as it is. Because if you can't see the world as it is, you certainly can't do much to improve on it, right? You might be in a denial or just have a complete lack of awareness on it.
So might I ask you to talk to us a bit about your experience with homelessness? I know that for many people, how they grew up, what they saw, what they experienced, certainly leads them in a certain direction, certainly sets a path for them in some way. Maybe they don't even see it at the time. Mm-hmm. What was your experience with homelessness and how did that begin to shape you?
Well, I think a lot of it is to the credit of my mother. She wasn't going to put up false walls and block us from the world around us. And she's a very religious woman. So she took my brother and I to feed the homeless out in the cold fall and winter days in the Washington, D.C. area, even when we were pretty young. So just spending time with the back of a van open and a big pot of chili, helping serve food to those who needed it, just showed me one, that there was need in the community and that there are people in my neighborhood who were cold, who were hungry, who I wasn't going to be exposed to unless I went out of my way to be exposed to them. So just having that awareness really early on. And then also just showed me that there was something that I could do about it, right? That sense of agency and action. I had a role to play. A small one, and it was a community thing, certainly wasn't all on my shoulders, but there was a way for even me as a little kid to help. And so that's just one example, but my mother was really lovely in exposing my brother and I to a number of examples like that of just, we're going somewhere, we have an extra spot in our car, how can we, prior to, you know, Lyft and Uber and all of that, but how can we use what we do have, the privileges, the space and the power to support and assist others, either as individuals or groups and close to home in our own communities? So that one was a beautiful one. I remember that the first time we went out to feed the homeless, suddenly I was asking to do it because it made me feel better. Once you're aware as a kid, it was like, yeah. It's cold again. Are we going to go out and feed the homeless? Because you're aware of it and you just want to help. And it really is such a satisfying thing to be able to do something about the circumstances around you, the things that are inequities. You know, I wouldn't have that word as a kid, but are things that would otherwise kind of eat me up, that it exists in our society.
David Eisner had a special upbringing that gave him a bird's eye view of disparity. And he's been spending much of his life trying to eliminate that while building bridges to different parts of our society. What was it about your early upbringing in your life that sort of shaped you for this life of service that you've had?
That's a terrific question, Art. I grew up as a transplanted New Yorker. My parents moved from New York to Santa Barbara, California when I was 3. And one of my earliest memories is when I was swimming in the pool in our backyard, and my parents brought a school of people with emotional and intellectual disabilities to come swim in the pool. I was maybe five, and I was helping some of them feel comfortable standing in the water, and I was bringing cookies to them as some of the students were getting out of the pool. I was playing host, and then I had this incredible experience where one young man was holding me so tightly as I was helping him float. And I've recalled this for a long time, this sense of how much it meant to him to be able to float in this pool and how much joy he took out of it and how my simply being there by his side mattered. And throughout my youth and young adulthood, I found myself looking for opportunities where I could feel of use to a person in that kind of way. And that naturally led me to find many different service opportunities that really carried me into my adult life.
Fascinating. What was some of the first things you did, maybe as a professional, that linked you with service and giving?
You know, when I got to Washington, D.C. after college, and I had thought, of course, that I was going to be the gift to the administration at the time, and that was not true. I ended up getting a job on Capitol Hill, which was really rough work. And although I know that intellectually I felt like I was of service to the country, it felt a lot more like throwing elbows around than it felt like service. And I found that I joined a hotline. Young people won't even remember what hotlines were, but if this was a called FACT hotline, Families and Children in Trouble, and mostly women who were dealing with issues of domestic abuse or who were contemplating suicide would call the hotline, and the trained people answering the phones, we would try to provide resources for them in the community. And we had a whole room filled with index cards on which all of these resources were written down. And I found that the friendships that I made and the colleagues that I met coming together, all of us trying to make the lives of the callers better, those became some of my closest colleagues in Washington. And I quickly realized that people that really spent time caring for other people were the people that I wanted to be spending my time with away from work.
For Pratici, culture is everything. And she will share with us why giving and culture matter so much in our society. Pratici, I wanted to talk a bit about your ethos for giving and service. And I know that you have an Indian heritage to go along with your now very deep American roots. And I wonder if the combination of family, American ideals, Indian heritage have in some ways shaped, and I'm sure they have in some to some degree, your brand of giving and serving and how they maybe together motivate you every day to not only work in this space, but decide to make a career out of it.
Yeah, it hinges, you're right. It's based on so many things. I think that there is an orientation in Indian culture around family and community and how you can orient towards others, how you can be in service. I think a really common question, a common dialogue, if you will, in conversation is always, do you need anything? Do you have what you need? Is there something I can do? And obviously, this is really top of mind as I watch so many people, including my family, grapple with what's going on in India right now with COVID. That phrase occurs continuously. Is there anything I can do? Do you need anything? Can I bring you something? Which obviously, if you're dealing with people across the ocean, not as practical. But I think that does orient you towards service. I mean, my family, my entire family gives to charity, and that's always been a part of our lives. I've always been quite conscious of that. And so I think that did inform my desire to then think about, okay, so how do I do that? Do I do that through my work? Do I make a donation somewhere? And kind of thinking that through is what led me to say, you know what, I think I want to go over there, meaning over to the nonprofit sector, and do some work there and see what that's like. And little did I know, as at the time a layperson to the sector, just how big the sector was, how layered it was, in that there's so much more than a layperson or a donor outside of the sector might see. There are organizations that address so many issues, and organizations that address the very work of charities themselves, as you well know, and the Wise Giving Alliance well knows. So what I was stunned by is, wow, there's a lot of ways to kind of be part of this thing. I didn't really know that. So that was very exciting. And it built on that foundation that had been laid via my family of how do you give back? How do you think about community? How do you contribute in some meaningful way?
It's been an exciting season. I hope you'll stay with us for season two. We have a great lineup of guests planned and topics that I know you'll be interested in. And I want to thank all of our listeners and subscribers and donors to the Heart of Giving podcast. We'd also appreciate it if you would give us a positive review, especially on Apple Podcasts, because this will help us build audience. If you want to do a little bit more, you can become a sustaining donor to the Heart of Giving podcast on patreon.com. That's patreon.com. And also, finally, if you want to reach us, because we'd love to hear from you, please do so on Facebook, or you can just send us an email to heartofgivingpod@gmail.com. Thank you very much.
You've just listened to the Heart of Giving podcast with Art Taylor. Be sure to tune in next time for a brand new episode. To listen to our other interviews, visit heartgiving.podbean.com. That's heartgiving.podbean.com. Subscribe to our show on major podcast platforms. The thoughts and opinions expressed on this podcast are the views and opinions of the guests, not those of the BBB Wise Giving Alliance or program affiliates. This podcast is for information and educational purposes only and is copyrighted with all rights reserved. This podcast is protected by Podbean's terms of service.